From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Hey, did you see what happened with the FBI today? They caught them cold. Comey either has the worst memory in history. Did you see? I don't remember that.
That was President Donald Trump in Duluth on Wednesday evening, discussing revelations that came to the fore during testimony by former FBI Director James Comey.
Did you spy on President Trump's campaign? Gee, I don't remember that. Did you go for a coup? Did you go for a coup? I don't remember. I know. I'll tell you, we caught him cold. It's about time that something happens, okay? It's about time that something happens. It's enough. We got plenty of information on these crooks. Bunch of crooks. Thing like that's never happened in the history of our country, and it's about time that something happens.
The president has been going from airport to airport to massive crowds of enthusiastic supporters. Meanwhile, former Vice President Joe Biden was on a whistle-stop tour of Ohio and was greeted by perhaps a dozen and a half people, including this reporter.
Mr. Vice President, thank you for giving me a question.
Hello. I think it's for, yes.
Oh, great. Okay. I wanted to, just about last night, you said a few things that put some distance between yourself and the liberal wing of the party on the Green New Deal and Medicare for All. Can you talk a little bit about whether or not you could be going a little bit too far to the center and alienating some people on the left? And related to that, have you spoken with Alexander AOC today or recently?
No, I haven't. I appreciated her endorsement. Look, we had a debate with 22, 25 people in the Democratic Party. I said at the time that I would tell you exactly what I believed, and I would state why I believed it and why I was running. And that's exactly what I did.
For more on all of this, we spoke with our political analyst, Professor Tony Montero, from Philadelphia via Skype on Thursday. Well, it sounds like a large crowd, of course, at the Trump event in Duluth, and not so big at the Ohio whistle stop of Joe Biden's yesterday. You could count on literally on two hands, including the Secret Service, the people that were there. And I'm guessing they didn't pan the crowd in Duluth, but thousands of people obviously there and very enthusiastic. And this reaction out of the Times, you know, and other places that somehow the debates need to be shut down now or else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, the first thing is Biden's sense that and his people's sense that they can win an election without a ground game. And they're using the excuse of the COVID-19 virus for the reason they can't mount a grassroots campaign. So they're going to put a lot of money into social media and into the corporate media and do it that way. But I think the big thing, and this is separate from the debate, perhaps we can get back to that, but the Biden campaign is using this idea of scaring the electorate and literally traumatizing tens of millions of people, saying to them that not only is the COVID virus a great threat to our health, but Donald Trump's presidency is the greatest threat to American democracy. And therefore, unless we stop Trump, we are looking at the end of American democracy. This is highly traumatizing to millions of people who are already traumatized by fear of the COVID-19 and of prospects that they will never work again and that they will lose everything that they have worked years and years to build up. So this is a very dangerous moment in American history, and it's hard to predict what will be the outcome, not only of the election, but the aftermath of the election.
It's an interesting construct all by itself. First of all, I don't want to get into the merits of any of these things. People were divided on almost everything, and they're divided on whose fault is the COVID virus, if it's anyone's fault, and masks, no masks, and you know all of this stuff. And rather than going there, there are some things that are true regardless. One is that this situation is unusual, to be sure. It's perhaps unprecedented in an election year, and it's also unprecedented happening at the conjunction of a number of other historical events. One of those being, you know, we are entering right now, or have been in the process of entering, a complete reconfiguration of the way that we talk to each other and relate to each other and even organize ourselves into a society away from personal physical contact, whether in the workplace or in schools or in restaurants or on the street, into our homes locked down through a TV screen, mediated. In other words, unmediated normal human interaction for our entire history up until now. And now at this moment, you know, superimposed over the normal processes that were evolving, you know, this emergency where human contact could be deadly, and people are being told that repeatedly. Mm-hmm. And then we've had the introduction of social media into our public discussion, and it played such a major role and a misunderstood role in the last election that it was blamed for stealing it somehow away from the natural processes that should have led to Hillary Clinton winning, to now rules governing social media from the owners of it that won't allow whole sections of the political conversation to be brought to the table, and super isolation from any other source of information. In other words, we've got as close to one person leading a chorus of conversation about the election as you could humanly arrange, happening at a moment where people are more isolated than they've ever been in history. And that has got to have some impacts. Also, as you said, being in fear of their jobs because the economy is being re-engineered in response to this emergency, quote-unquote. Restaurant workers are out of work. School teachers are looking at being out of work. All of the, you know, aides and other people that were involved in the school systems, for example, most of those are out of work. There's nobody on the playground. There's nobody in the nurse's office and all of that stuff. And the rest of the economy, you know, similar. People are working at home instead of in the office, and the people who worked in the buildings that maintained those offices are all out. So this whole unprecedented shift from personal contact to virtual communication is taking place at the same time that we've had our first virtual political conventions, and now actually a virtual election, it looks like.
Well, at least from the Biden side. And that's what they're calling it, a virtual campaign. But they're sending the message over and over again that you need to be afraid. You need to be afraid of your neighbor. You need to be afraid of your coworker. You need to be afraid of everyone because she or he is potentially an enemy. And the greatest demon, the great devil in this whole mix is Donald Trump. But this is doing psychological damage to the American people, besides the fact that it is shutting down discussion, it is shutting down the possibility of the people being politically educated and arriving at different levels of ideological clarity at a time when ideas and ideology could be more important than ever before.
Really?
So people are in this dystopic bubble, and they don't know what to do. And the possibilities of alternative left, radical, revolutionary leadership emerging organically are made all the more difficult because of this shutdown. And I think the greatest shutdown is the political ideological shutdown, where the progressive and revolutionary forces are bearing the heaviest burden of this. And I would say, well, we could say some things about the Black Lives Matter movement, these demonstrations, and what does it mean when people are in the streets without leadership? I mean, it becomes a part of the traumatizing of a part of the population. I mean, there are people who look at Black Lives Matter movements and say, this is not me. They're not fighting for the things that I want to fight for. I mean, it's a very difficult moment and a very dangerous moment.
And then in the absence of leadership, in the absence of organic working class leadership, organic Black leadership, organic Brown leadership, in the absence of all of that, you have these people that are in the streets and they're pushing the same agenda that's being pushed by the corporate and nonprofit media and those 17 intelligence agencies. What the CIA says about Trump is exactly what the people in the street are saying about Trump and about, more importantly, about the people that support him.
Well, let's be real. First of all, this is not a civil rights movement.
Right.
It does not look like a civil rights movement, and the people in it don't behave like civil rights activists or civil rights leaders. I mean, just if you look at it, this looks more like a color revolution, be it in the Ukraine, be it in Hong Kong, or be it in Belarus.
Right.
But it does not look like a civil rights movement. And so one has to question who is behind all of this. And obviously, we do know that tremendous amounts of money to fuel the Black Lives Matter movement is coming from Silicon Valley and the multi-billionaires of the high-tech digital world are pumping a lot of money into it. Hollywood is pumping a lot of money. And of course, the Soros Foundation has said that it is giving $240 million to various social justice organizations, whoever that is and whatever that is. So this is not a civil rights movement. It is not a movement that we usually associate with revolutionary or radical change. But it is, in its basic essence, an anti-Trump movement, which means that it is going parallel to what is being called the deep state.
Right. And that deep state, we're talking the CIA, you know, the basically all, the DNI, basically Director of National Intelligence. Meanwhile, you're starting to see come out of there. See, you have the actual institutions of the CIA, the FBI, the various you know, the military intelligence groupings. You know, all of these different agencies have a built-in, they have a bureaucracy, they have careerists, and they have, you know, an officer class that's kind of been working a revolving door, you know, more or less since the founding of the CIA in the 1940s, if not earlier. And, you know, there hasn't been much talk about this even being a problem. Certainly from anyone in the White House, since John Kennedy mentioned it and then mysteriously found a hole blown in his head shortly after that.
Right.
Trump has been doing it, and he's installed people in different senior positions. Some have not been able to accomplish anything and left pretty quickly. I'm wondering if we're seeing a sea change now with the Director of National Intelligence, Ratcliffe, who issued this letter the other day, and basically picking apart a handwritten note that was put together by the former FBI director, memorializing Hillary Clinton meeting with Barack Obama and talking about doing to Trump what was done to Trump with the campaign spying and stuff.
Yeah. But see, in spite of that, the big headlines are that the greatest threat to the upcoming election and the orderly transition of power and our democracy is Donald Trump. Now, you put all of this together, we're looking at a crisis the likes of which we've never seen. And a crisis of this magnitude without a left, without a progressive movement. And those who claim to be the left, let us say the Noam Chomskys, the Cornel West, well, I'll put his name in there, Bob Avakians.
Right.
Others who are literally saying the same thing that the intelligence community is saying, the New York Times is saying. They are saying, all of them are saying in one or another way, that Donald Trump is a fascist.
Right.
And he has to be gotten out of office because he is cooperating with Putin in undermining, quote, our democracy.
Right.
You know, if I were one of those leftists who has rushed to support Biden because of these claims about Trump, and I heard that what I was saying sounded very much like people in the upper echelons of the intelligence community, I would take a step back, because one thing is for certain, these are the very people who have supported the overthrow of democracy for the last 75 years throughout the world.
Everywhere
in the world.
I would say beyond supporting it, conducted the overthrow of democracy.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. Conducted it. And you don't have to believe me, but do your own research. Look at the Ukraine. 2013, 2014. Look at Libya, 2011.
Right.
Look at Iraq. Look at Syria.
Right.
I mean, don't you see certain similarities here?
Guatemala, Chile, Dominican Republic. I mean, where you want to go?
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to, be a rocket scientist to see certain things that look very much the same.
Right.
Now, perhaps you think the movement in Hong Kong against China is a democratic movement. Well, if you believe that, I have a bridge to sell you in Brooklyn.
Right.
And I don't own it, by the way.
Right.
So we're in a ludicrous time, a time where clarity and ideology and principled politics don't mean a damn to most people who claim to be leaders and claim to be leftists.
You know, these two pieces in the Times over the last 2 days, my post debate, one being titled "For the Sake of Democracy, Cancel the Debates," the Trump-Biden debates. This is Frank Bruni. And the other being Tuesday's debate made clear the gravest threat to the election, the president himself, and that's by David E. Sanger. I'm just going to take sort of the central argument from each one. These are, within a day of each other in the New York Times. So he says, this is the piece that was written by Frank Bruni. He says, little more than 12 hours after the debate was over, he published a column calling on Biden to refuse to participate in the second or third debate. Yeah. And he's got these problems with it, that Trump acted like a spoiled child, a machine gun of interruptions, a gusher of insults. If you watch back and forth, actually, the form that two of them used was actually pretty much the same one. It's just that Trump was better at it. And he says, but that's not the real problem, but rather that they're enabling Trump's core strategy, which is to make voters so disgusted that they'll walk away from the election, and so distrustful that if he rejects the official results, they'll believe him. In other words, they say he's maneuvering himself into position to steal the election. As he calls on Biden to not participate in debates, being the first president to not participate in debates that I can remember going back to John Kennedy and Nixon in 1960, and the first one to call on that for sure since the League of Women Voters had it taken away from them and handed to the corporate shills that conduct it now. In other words, the game has been so rigged for 30 years that the League of Women Voters wasn't allowed to participate in it is now not rigged enough for Biden to participate. So this guy, Frank Bruni, is calling on Biden to go home. That's one side. The other, Sanger, is talking about Trump is unwilling to say he would abide by the result, and his disinformation campaign about the voting, etc. They keep talking about how Trump's claims of the possibility of voter fraud have been completely repudiated without ever showing you the repudiation. It says Trump's unwillingness to say he would abide by the result and his disinformation campaign about election fraud go beyond anything President Vladimir V. Putin could have imagined. So we're back to that.
Mm-hmm. And look, don't forget, if you saw Wednesday's New York Times, where this article is front page, it is a headline across the entire front page.
Wow.
On the level of the headlines that dominated newspapers all across the country when 9/11 happened.
Yeah,
in other words, the New York Times is looking upon Trump and the possibility that he could win,
right,
as an existential threat,
right,
very much on par with 9/11. If you just look at the huge headline in Wednesday's New York Times.
Wow, I mean that says a lot. And so, what is it exactly that they see as the first of all an existential threat to whom? You have, well, you know, well, 330 million people here, so I don't
right,
see it
right.
as an existential threat.
No, but they do. They see Trump as an existential threat to the state. That's the way they're looking at him. That's the way they're defining him. And if he wins again, if he is reelected, the election must be nullified. He cannot be sworn in again as the president of the United States, and everything over the next 32 days must be done to make sure that Trump is not reelected. It is a very dangerous thing. They are defining him as an existential threat to the state itself.
So we're looking at this message, more or less, has been coming from the media now since, I would guess, from when Trump first suggested back in 2015 that NATO was obsolete. I think he actually stated it when he actually stated it. Mm-hmm. They started treating him like persona non grata on the national stage, whereas before they would clink glasses with him as he walked through the set. Mm-hmm. And one thing after another, I mean, you know, they sequence PR catastrophe after another for him, one scandal, quote unquote, after another for him. After doing that, regardless, they find that his numbers don't change at all, or they go up once in a while a little bit, despite the wall-to-wall effort throughout their entire machinery, engineered by their entire intelligence operation, they're unable to crack like half the American population, or maybe slightly less than half the American population. Now, there are people who call themselves Marxists, and there are people who call themselves, you know, liberation revolutionaries or black radical revolutionaries or whatever other designation that say that that's because that 45% or whatever are the deplorables who are racist and that that's what motivates their politics and that no matter what happens, you can't shake them from it. But, you know, I would say you could suggest that in this culture, and it's not ridiculous because of the nature of the history of this country. But once you bring a little proof about those numbers, because I disagree. And why is it that that group are the outliers when the institutions that were built by that racist white supremacist ideology and practice are the ones that are attacking Trump?
Yeah. I mean, by the way, so you don't feel alone, Martin Luther King would have agreed with you, as would James Baldwin and W.E.B. Du Bois.
Okay.
They would never, in spite of the structural and institutional and political economic difficulties for the working class to come together, they would never close the door to the possibility, as we're seeing now, of a white working class rejection of all of the major institutions of white supremacy. In other words, these people are being defined as white supremacists just because they're white.
Right.
If you are white, you are by definition a white supremacist. And there are a whole lot of books that have come out recently saying that, including Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility and Ibram Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist. But they begin from the assumption that all white people are almost congenitally racist. And in particular, the white poor and the white working class are the principal reservoir of white supremacy. And the most woke white people are like the tech billionaires, the billionaires of the digital economy and so on. But the white working class are by definition racist. And therefore, they're saying to black people, don't attempt to unite with people whose economic and social conditions are like yours. But that then is translated, translated into a narrative about Trump. Trump is a white supremacist. He cannot deny white, he cannot condemn white supremacists. Well, I halfway understand what he's doing, because what they want him to do is to attack all white people.
Right.
His base are white people.
Right.
You know? And so what is he going to do?
Right.
Because he, I mean, he knows instinctively or even from his own study of the situation that they want him. And that's what Chris Wallace was attempting to do. They want him to attack the very people who are the base of the political movement that he's in the front of right now.
Right. You know, Dr. King, Du Bois, and Baldwin all would recognize the impossibility of doing their life work and not including the white working class in the liberation of humanity. It's just not mathematically possible. And you know,
right.
By the way,
when
you start, you know, parsing which segments of the population, you know, when you're in 10, 20, 30, 40%, 50% chunks about who's not going to live into the next epoch, no matter what the individual ideology of the people that you're talking about is, you have the wrong ideology.
Absolutely.
And that's all the news we have for you right now.
For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.